You're listening to a special showcase episode of the Roundtable Podcast. 20 Minutes with Nathan Lowell. Literary Alchemists, I'm Dave Robison.
And I'm Brian Humphrey.
And you're listening to a special showcase episode of the Roundtable Podcast, 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is an opportunity for Dave and I to sit down with some really, really cool people and talk to them about the craft of writing. And today, I think this might be the first time that we have a returning guest host.
This is momentous, Brian.
Absolutely. This is fabulous. Yes. And this guy's really cool.
Yeah. So, and honestly, Brian, I'm torn. I'm torn because just as our guest host has written many, many stories, there are just as many stories about the man himself. So I'm torn between our duty to our new listeners who may not know about his groundbreaking and award-winning Golden Age of the Solar Clipper series,
right,
available in its entirety out at patiobooks.com and in ebook format. They may not be aware of his Tanith Fairport series that starts with the novel Ravenwood and continues in the soon-to-be-released Zyphiria's Call. These new listeners won't know that his name has become a unit of measure for written word count. So when you achieve a 10 to 20,000 word sitting, that you have achieved a Lowellian word count. But Brian, there's so much more to our guest hosts that you and I find intriguing. Am I right?
Absolutely, yes.
Well, and I'd like to try and paint a picture of the man that you and I have come to know.
Sure.
That man grew up in Maine and built a computer for his sixth grade science fair, where he took second place because no one really understood the value of bits and bytes back in the 1960s. It was also around this time that his love for sci-fi and fantasy sparked and set a fire in his imagination. A fire, I might add, that utterly exhausted the local library's sci-fi selection. So it fell to his aunt, who was also a voracious reader, to drop off a paper grocery bag full of Ace doubles every month, and a double is where you got two novellas in one book printed back to back, to keep up with his voracious appetite. Now, after this, he wrote. For 40 years, he wrote, but other than a poem published while he was in elementary school, publication eluded him. Now, he was far from idle during those 40 years. He served in the Coast Guard, seeing duty aboard a cutter on hurricane patrol in the North Atlantic and at a communication station in Kodiak, Alaska. His educational background: bachelor's in business administration, master's in educational technology. Note that transition. Doctorate in educational technology with a specialization in distance learning and instructional design. And this, dear friends, is where the catalyzing event occurred. Podcasting had come into being, and with his interest in distance learning, it was only natural that he'd explore it. Now, those explorations led him to ultimately start writing again and to podcast his fiction. Now, check this out, Brian. In just a few short years, his fan base grew to such proportions that when he released an audiobook on patiobooks.com in 2010, the surging tide of download requests literally crashed the servers. Now, that's amazing in and of itself, but those very same fans, when they learned about the catastrophe they had caused, donated thousands of dollars to allow the servers to be rebuilt and upgraded.
It's awesome.
It is. And that last part, I think, is probably the most telling. The people who respond and resonate to our guest host's particular and unorthodox style of storytelling are not among the common herd. They are the people who build computers when no one understands why, who understand that more often than not, truth is not found on the beaten path. It's found in the tall weeds by people whose curiosity is stronger than their desire to fit in and whose passion for a single startling moment of truth sustains them through long years of tedious convention. That's the man that you and I know, Brian, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
And from a personal standpoint for you and me, he's the first author to actually ask us to be a guest host on the show. And he's the first one to write back and ask, when are we doing it again? So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back to the big chair at the round table, Mr. Nathan Lowell. Nathan, welcome back to the round table podcast, sir.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be back.
It is. Have a cup of coffee.
I've got one, thanks.
What a shock. All right, let me set the timer here for our 20 minutes together, and let's launch into this.
Definitely. And before you begin, Dave, I just want to throw one thing out there. And this is just another thing to show kind of who we have come to know Nathan as. And he's so giving of his time and of his talent that he's come in and spoken to my creative writing class a couple times now to several different classes. And he's actually spearheading a group to take some of my students and take them through the process of not only writing a novel, but publishing it as well by Christmas.
That's awesome.
Which is really cool. And, you know, and I don't even have to pay him as far as I know yet.
That's very cool, Nathan. Have you been planning that long?
We've been talking about doing it all summer long, and then we finally got it together. I went in last week, and I think our first session's tomorrow morning, isn't it, Brian?
Yep, that's right, yeah.
That's awesome. Those kids are so lucky.
Oh, and they're excited, too.
Oh, I'll bet. I'll bet. What an opportunity.
I'm excited.
Well, Nathan, let me ask you. One of the quotes that I have found the most engaging of yours is that you don't really think you have any good answers, but you hope you're asking some interesting questions. And one of the things that I'd really like to know about you right now is, what questions are you asking these days? I would imagine that as time goes by, experience accumulates, the world changes, the questions that you're asking, that you're seeking the answers to, changes. So what questions are you asking these days?
I'm asking questions in terms of craft. I'm asking questions of how can I make my story stronger? How can I make them be more what I want to say? And I'm looking for new ideas to write about. I really need to have some sort of theme that I'm exposing, that I'm dealing with. And so I've got two series that have, the six book Share series has completed, although there'll be more Ishmael Wong stories. And there's a lot of that universe that I'm asking questions about, because I've sketched a surface layer and I've not really gone too deep beyond that surface layer. And the next round of stories should go deeper. And I need to consider, how does that sound? How does that look like? What will happen there? I'm also wondering about the evolution of the economic engine that drives everyone. How will these students that I'm going to talk to tomorrow make a living? And will they make a living from writing? For the first time ever, for the first time in at least 300 years, writers will be able to make a living writing again. And that's pretty exciting. How does the technology integrate with economics? What happens when everyone who has a computer has a storefront on a global marketplace? And how does that change culture? How does that change society? How will that change us here in the U.S.? And how will it change the rest of the world in its relationships with us? So I'm asking some really kind of internal questions, like, how can I tell a better story? And I'm asking some kind of big questions, like, what the heck is education going to be?
Indeed. Especially with the tendency towards privatization and...
Right.
Yeah. Those are some weighty questions. I'd like to actually go back when you talk about how do you make your story stronger. What do you mean by stronger exactly?
Well, when I started writing the novels in particular, when I started writing the Ishmael Wong stories, I really just wrote the stories I wanted to read, and so there's a lot of structure that isn't in those stories that many people find troubling, that is not there, and I understand why they find it troubling, and I don't think that I would change the books that I've written, but by the same token, those structures do help. Help the reader understand what's happening. They do help the reader understand how the story is unfolding. So they're not trying to figure out two things at once. The cognitive load on an oddly structured story is quite high. Not only are they trying to figure out what the story is, but they're trying to figure out how it's put together. If I can put together stories that are still my stories, still compelling, but are in a structure that is more conducive to understanding, then I think the stories will be stronger and more compelling, and ultimately will find more readers.
Okay. Well, and one of the defining aspects of the Solar Clipper series is that planets aren't blown up. There are no space fights. It's a very, in terms of sci-fi tropes and space opera, it's very subversive in that respect. Are you thinking about going in a different direction away from that?
No.
Good.
No. See, one of the things that drives the whole Solar Clipper universe is that where most space opera deals with physical, literal warfare, the Solar Clipper universe deals with a much more, and I'll use the term, a much more subversive idea.
Sure.
And that's that business is economic warfare.
Right.
Which comes,
is very relevant to our times.
Absolutely. And so one of the things that I... when I was in business, one of the things that I was studying at the time was Sun Tzu's Art of War in relationship to how the Japanese and Koreans use the philosophy of Sun Tzu to govern their economic policy. And so I studied Sun Tzu's Art of War, and I studied the Book of Five Rings.
Right.
To understand how those things work together and how that defines business. And so with that idea and the notion of the company town, the Solar Clipper universe was born. So these people are what we have seen of them so far is very almost benign, almost banal. But we've only seen one facet from one perspective of one person. And we've had hints of problems. In the final book, the Owner's Share book, where we begin to see Ishmael operate at a much higher level than ship captain, he begins to see some things that are unusual. And some of the spin-off stories, The Shaman's Tale, South Coast, where there is an odd religious sect that does something different in one of the worlds. And then Odin's Outpost, which is the novella that's a spin-off as well, Odin's Outpost hints at a dark underbelly that is apparently out there, but because Ishmael is on a particular trajectory, hasn't seen until the very end of Owner's Share. And so I don't see it changing. We're not going to have big intergalactic wars, because intergalactic war is not good for business.
Right. But the stage will shift.
I think the stage will shift. I think the perspective will shift. And I think there's some growth that has to happen for Ishmael, because in many ways, as a character, he has some flaws, and those flaws have caused him to be where he is at the end of the sixth book. And what we need to do is to figure out how those flaws cause him to grow over the course of, say, the next three.
Okay.
Right. So to pull out just a little bit more globally, because you kind of talked about this a little bit to my class the other day, at what point do you decide that a series, or at least the current story arc, is done and needs to end and needs to go in a different direction?
Well, with the Share series, it was really easy, because once I ran out of pay grades, I ran out of stories. with the Tanith Fairport series, I really didn't intend that to be a series. I intended it to be a single book. And by the time I got to the end of about 100,000 words and realized that I hadn't really begun yet, then I began to look at how that beginning trajectory might get to where I wanted it to go. Because I know where it wants to go. I know what the third book in the series is. I know what the second, well, of course, now I know what the second book in the series is. But I know what the third book in the series is, in part because I finally finished the second book. And so it's really, for me, it's an organic growth. I know an awful lot of people who are really, you know, we have to plot this out. We have to have an outline. I have to know which pieces go where, because if I don't know where they're going to go, then I don't know how to get there. And for me, if I know where it's going to go, if I have it plotted out too tightly, then there's no sense to write the book. The excitement of discovering how the story is going to unfold is lost to me. And once that excitement is lost to me, I can't write the book.
Tough to infuse the words with any excitement at that point.
Yeah, I have to discover it, and in the discovery is where the magic happens.
I can only imagine you at your keyboard, Nathan, when something occurs to you. I'd imagine there's all sorts of hoots and howls and shrieks of delight as you stumble across something. No?
No. When I'm in the zone, when I get in the flow, as they say, I'm dead quiet. I'm absolutely still, and the only thing that moves is my fingers.
Wow.
I'm absolutely still because I'm in the story. I'm not out here. I'm not sitting at my keyboard. I'm typing away 120 words a minute and just blowing through it.
Right.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Nathan Lowell after this brief promotional break. Storytelling has been a part of our lives since the dawn of civilization. But to this day, authors and readers still discuss and debate the perfect blend of character, plot, and setting to craft a great story. Now you can be a part of that discussion. Geek and Sundry presents a remarkable monthly series titled The Storyboard. Hosted by Patrick Rothfuss, author of The Name of the Wind and Wise Man's Fear, each episode is a live panel discussion on the very essence of the writer's craft. Gathering a different constellation of stellar authors for each panel, The Storyboard offers up a live discussion that is vibrant, diverse, and sometimes contentious, but always relevant to today's dynamic world of storytelling. The Storyboard discussions occur on the first Tuesday of every month at 8 p.m. Pacific Time on Google Hangouts. Just subscribe to the Geek & Sundry YouTube channel or add Geek & Sundry on Google+ to receive notifications. The Storyboard, continuing the quest for how to tell a great story. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Nathan Lowell.
Now to that, just to kind of go in a little bit of a different direction, you know, in talking to you, you're definitely the master of the lightning draft, right? When it comes to producing long form writing, you're very, very fast.
Yeah.
Well, the revision process seems to be equally as fast, but what does that really entail? Like, do you have specific process or a sequence of tasks that you follow when going through your revision?
Well, to be clear, I type on average, I write 1,000 words an hour. So when I'm in creative mode, it's 1,000 words an hour. And if I am productive over the course of the day, it's because I will write 10 or 12 or 18 hours in a day. So I don't write particularly fast. A lot of people write faster than I do. Now, I do, on occasion, manage to slide into the zone. And in those times, I will write between 2,000 and 5,000 words in an hour.
Whoa. Wow.
But those are rare. They don't happen very often. I can't claim to control them. They are just things that happen.
That's almost a transformative Zen moment, really.
Yeah, no, it is. It really is. It's when you stand up from the computer and you realize that it's dark, and it was dark when you sat down. But what you don't remember is the sun coming up and going down again. Those are the days that you really live for, because then you get to the end of the day and you've almost written a novel that day.
Sure.
The process is I write the draft, and typically I write off the end of the story. That is, I'm writing along, and I'm thinking, okay, there's another couple chapters, there's some boys, there's some things I want to tie up, there's this thing going on, and I get to it, and I write this line, and then I go to write the next line, and there isn't another line. Right. It isn't there. Story's over. And when I write that line, when I realize that the story is over, sometimes there's been once where I actually said, no, that can't be the end of the story, I have to write some more. And once I ended too soon, but generally it's I write off the end of the story. It's like you're running across the cliff and all of a sudden you fall down. Oh, there it is.
I've reached the end. Ah!
I've reached the end.
Wile E. Coyote comes to mind.
Wile E. Coyote comes to mind. So then typically I have beta readers who are reading as the chapters come out. So by the time I finish my first draft, I've already had somebody read it.
Are they giving you feedback while you're writing?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Does this work? Does this not work? All that.
Okay.
And how many do you have?
Two or three.
Okay. All right.
I don't have a lot. And sometimes they'll get busy in their own lives until somebody will catch up and I'll have to sort of like prod them a bit. But no, I got two or three people who read for me on a regular basis. And then the second draft is pulling out the main themes. I really do follow, inadvertently, I follow Stephen King's pattern in that you write the draft and then you go through and you see what the themes were. It's like, how did this plot unfold? How did this work? Is there something I need to do to beef up this piece, or is there something I need to do to pare down that part? Right. Is there details that I need in the back half of the book, now that I know where it's going, that I need to seed into the front end of the book? And a lot of times the beta readers will say, well, this came out of the clear blue sky. And it's like, mm-hmm. Well, how do you mean it came out? It was like right back here in chapter 3. And it's like, well, yeah, but I didn't see it. And it's like, well, okay. And then it's up to me to determine, do I want to make them see it? Or do I want to have it be a surprise when they get there? And then they can go back and say, oh, yeah, it was there.
Right.
Okay.
And so I do a revision for basic continuity. Does the story flow? And are the pieces there that need to be there? Are they in the right proportion? And then the last draft is one for copy edit. Are there words missing? Is the punctuation gone? Is there spelling errors?
Grammar or so on.
I don't worry too much about grammar.
Okay.
No, I'm serious. Because a lot of fiction, even in the narrative, has to be from the character's point of view.
Right.
And so
right.
If the character is prone to using bad grammar in his dialogue, and you have to be very careful about using proper grammar in the narrative, particularly in like the Ishmael stories where they're first person, because it's always Ishmael talking.
Right.
Ways. And even when you're using a close third point of view, everything that goes on the page has to be coming through the character's eyes and in his mind. And so putting your own grammar into the character's mind is not really a good way to go about it.
Right. Good point.
So
interesting.
Grammar is, you know, you want to try to make it understandable. You can't be like, and I'm not, you know, even going to try to be like Finnegan's Wake or something, but you do have to be aware that there is a voice that is not just yours as author, but the voice of the character that you're trying to portray as well. So grammar, oddly enough, grammar isn't really one of them. Now, structure. So that if you're using quotes and dialogue tags and all the rest of that stuff, now that stuff is deadly, and you really need to pay attention to that. But for me, it's very challenging because I write primarily for audio. I write primarily to be read aloud.
Sure.
And so I have to use more dialogue tags because the reader does not have the clues that the physical page can help them keep track of who's speaking.
Right.
So I have to use a lot more dialogue tags and a lot of action tags in lieu of dialogue tags so people can keep track of what's going on as they're listening while they're doing something else, typically driving or washing dishes or whatever.
Sure.
And the audio reading aloud and editing is a fourth pass. And so I quite frequently will change things that I can't speak. and that's really a good thing, because if I can't say it, then when you read it, it doesn't make sense.
Sure.
Sure.
Although I can tell you that I having done some voice work since last we spoke, that there are stories that were never, ever meant to be read out loud.
Amen.
Clearly, these people did not go through this last pass. And yet, as a literary work, it stands quite effectively.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I do a lot of editing when I go from the last audio pass to the first publishing pass.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I will go back through and take out the extraneous dialogue tags. I will reset some of the sentences. I will change some of the wording around so it lays on the page better.
Okay.
But I'm very aware of things that don't sound odd when you write them. And the famous one that I always go back to is P.G. Holyfield wrote a book, Murder at Avedon Hill.
Right.
And there was a place in there called Corin's Hold. And whenever he said Corin's Hold, it always made me giggle. That was always one of the things that I always have been careful about is to do things, to write words that actually I can actually say and have people understand what they are without having them sound like something rude.
Something else.
Something else. Yeah. Saying one thing and meaning your mother.
Oh, that's classic. Nathan, you gave an interview for epublishunum.com. And in that interview, you say, I try to use tropes in ways that make stories unmistakable members of a particular genre, but also unmistakably, quote, Nathan Lowell stories.
Yeah.
Which speaks to the issue of arthurial voice.
Yeah.
As well as just a sense of confidence as you stride to the page. Have you found your arthurial voice, sir?
I think so. Okay. When I started, I wasn't sure. I didn't know. And I think one of the things that authors have to do is to put their voice out there and see if it resonates, to see if anybody wants to hear it. And I think a lot of people have authorial voices that nobody really wants to hear.
Sure.
And that's one of the yeah. issues. It's like, yeah, this is my voice. Shut up.
We don't want to hear it.
and so, you know, the question is, yeah, I think I found it because my touchstone is I still have people who are writing to me. I just got 6 messages today. When's the next book coming out?
So what is a Nathan Lowell story?
Oh, well, first is a story of ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. None of my stories have anything to do with, by their nature, people who are kings, princes, although Ishmael Wong is now rich, but he may not stay rich.
He didn't start out that way.
He didn't start that way, and he may not stay that way. And part of what made him rich was not his doing. And so that was interesting, too. In terms of the Tanith Fairport adventures, Tanith Fairport has to be a strong character in her own right. She can never be rescued, for example. She will never be the rescued princess. She will never be the rescued damsel in any story that I write. So she has her own space, her own place, her own reality that she participates in. But she's an ordinary person in an extraordinary circumstance. The same with Ishmael Wong, all of his stories, ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. Now, I've written some pulpy pieces that are, perhaps they are my kinds of stories, or maybe they aren't. There is a story making the rounds. You can find it in audio if you listen carefully to a certain Balticon podcast. Mm. You can hear me read a story that has only one copy published, and it's called The Hidalgo.
Right. Okay.
And that's definitely a Nathan Lowell story, but it's also a horror story, yeah. which is an interesting take on it.
Well, and the steampunk story that you did for Pip and T, that was very pulpy.
Was very pulpy, but it was also one of my stories.
Yeah.
It was about basically an ordinary guy in an extraordinary circumstance.
Right, right.
And it was really an homage to H. Rider Haggard as much as anything.
Okay. That was a marvelous tale.
Thank you.
One of the challenges that I see with young writers, especially with kids in the class, and I think that this is something that you may see, or maybe you can even help me with when we're going through that process, is that they have not had an opportunity to write creatively for the majority of their life. Education has gone in a direction where it's all summary writing. It's read this and summarize it, read this and summarize it. And so they slip really easily between first person and third person, between past tense and present tense, and they have a hard time finding the difference. And we spend so much time trying to get them to write accurately and academically that it all, in the end, it all comes out sounding exactly the same. So how do you find, or how do you help somebody find that voice or get past that block that they have?
Well, I think it goes back to giving them permission to fail. Ira Glass has a famous spiel on storytelling, and in it, he gives everyone permission to suck. And so one of the things that you have to do in order to be a writer is not be afraid to suck, because you have to realize that everybody sucks.
Right.
I mean, at the beginning, when you start out, it doesn't necessarily all fall nice and neatly off the ends of your fingers or off the ends of your pen or whatever. And I think in working with the kids, I think it's going to be an interesting challenge for me to help them come to grips with the difference that the extended flow will give them. For one thing, I think writing an extended piece will help them because it will need to be consistent across the length of the piece. So what they pick in terms of point of view and tense in the very beginning will be something that they will have to maintain the flow of. And because they'll have to work toward honing the ability to maintain the flow, they'll be so focused on maintaining the flow I'm betting that their voice emerges naturally.
Right.
That would be very cool.
Yeah. So what I've tried to do is distract them enough with technique that their voices mm-hmm. will happen by themselves.
Well, and I think a lot of people tend to focus on perception of their work, that, mm-hmm. that they're less concerned about telling a good story than they are about how other people will perceive the story.
Yeah. Right. And not just the story, but how other people will perceive them.
Them. Yeah.
You know, because I did an assignment with them where they had to come up with a pseudonym. And then once they wrote their pseudonym down and didn't have their actual name, they could write whatever they wanted. It could be as crazy, horrific, raunchy, whatever they wanted, because it wouldn't be traced back to them. And still nobody did.
Wow.
They all still held back. There were some really cool things that came out of it, but they still held back even when they were given license to put anything that they wanted on the paper.
Yeah. And I think it is very hard, and it's particularly hard for people who are at that stage in their life when what somebody else thinks is of paramount importance.
Gentlemen, I hate to say this, but the clock has wound down, kicked over my ashtray, and stomped out in a huff once again. So, and I Nathan, I can't tell you how much it means to have you come back and to continue this discussion. This has been a wonderful exploration, as always. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Brian, closing thoughts, considerations? Yeah. I'm basking in the glow of it.
Absolutely. And I'm super, super excited to see where this project goes. And I think it, you know, again, I just want to say that it really shows the quality of your character that you're willing to, you know, to sacrifice some of your time to work with these kids and to help them out. And it's an opportunity that if I had it when I was in high school, you know, I would have jumped at it, and I'd probably be in a different place right now. So it's really, really cool, and I appreciate everything that you're doing for them.
Thanks. You're welcome.
Well, and make no mistake, for Nathan, it's also a grand experiment to see where it's all going to go. So
yeah, actually, it is. It's like how do we inculcate this kind of idea into an educational curriculum? Because education means schedule. And unfortunately, learning doesn't. Yeah. And so there's an opportunity for me to play a little bit with education and with learning and with schedule.
I will look forward. I think all of us, in fact, Brian, we probably need to set something up for the roundtable to continue to check back in as this project unfolds. I think that'd be very
absolutely
cool. So, yeah. And for myself, I finally got it about you, Nathan, is that you trust. You trust your muse. You trust you trust the stories that are coming out of you. You trust faithfully in the characters that are evolving as you write, and that kind of surrender to the muse, to that creative process, is incredibly liberating. And that's I think a lesson for certainly for me. I hope for somebody else as well.
Sure, and trust in your readers.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, which I think plays into that as
And trust in your listeners, who always keep coming back. So thank you guys so much for returning each week, each twice a week, actually. We so appreciate that. If you're having a good time, spread the word, kids. One other person that finds out about the roundtable is like a big plate of blintzes. Cheese blintzes for me and Brian. Well, for me, Brian, I don't know if you like blintzes or not. But I like blintzes.
It's got cheese, I'm all over it.
It's got cheese. It's blintzes. It's good. You'll like it. So feel free to pop out to iTunes, give us a rating or a review. We always love that. And thank you to those who have a comment on. Yes, definitely. A comment on the message board. On the message board. Yeah, we don't have one of those yet, but we will. But a comment on the posts is always welcome. And so many of you have been doing that, and we are deeply grateful. It just continues the discussion. The process doesn't have to end when we flip the off switch. And you can always send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Some of you have been doing that as well, and that means the world to us. Friends, stay tuned. In just a few days, we'll have Nathan back, and we'll be workshopping an oh-so-awesome martial arts story. Oh, you guys have got to come back. It's going to be fabulous.
Sweet.
But until then, you got to do something with your time. Brian, any ideas?
Go write.
Go read Sun Tzu and write.
Yes.
Yeah, Book of the Five Rings. And for my part, as always, friends, you find what you're looking for. So if you're going to look for something, make it awesome. Make it fabulous, and you will find it. Thanks again for tuning in. We will see you in just a few days. Until then, take care. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.